warming up earlier in the spring and it stays warmer later into the falls. And where it used to be come Labor Day, we were pretty much out of fire season. And anymore, it goes way past Labor Day.
The impacts of climate change on firefighting. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state corrections officers want the governor to reject parts of a scathing review of their work.
I am going to take every action that's necessary to make sure that the public knows that those officers did not commit a crime.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The State Corrections Officers Union wants Governor Bill Walker to retract key sections of a report released last year that criticized Department of Corrections policies and some officers' actions. But Acting Corrections Commissioner Dean Williams says he's moving forward to address what he sees as needed changes to the department. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Alaska Correctional Officers Association business manager Brad Wilson says Commissioner Williams defamed and slandered officers in an administrative review that Williams co-wrote in November.
One, they're innocent. They should have never been vilified in the press and in that report. That was wrong. They are innocent. They did not do the things that he said they did. Second, safety. Right now, that report is basically saying that they did things wrong, but right now, today, they're being ordered to do those exact same things.
In the review, Williams and co-author retired FBI agent Joe Hanlon looked into deaths in jails and prisons. They found what Williams called a broken system, with numerous problems that contributed to four deaths they specifically examined. They also called for external reviews of deaths in corrections facilities. They said many policies were outdated and solitary confinement was used too widely. Wilson sent a letter to the governor on Monday asking him to retract criticism of officers included in the review. He also released a 51-page rebuttal of the review that said that the officers correctly followed procedures.
You can't take one piece of information and then twist and turn it like that. He was looking to make a name for himself. He was looking to do it on the backs of correction officers that did nothing wrong. Nothing. It's not even close to what he said in the report. And now he's the commissioner.
For his part, Williams says he's looking forward. He declined to defend details of the review.
I could go point by point and say, I just disagree. I don't think they are the facts. But the most important thing for me is to understand that wherever we were, we don't have to stay there.
Williams says he's willing to work with anyone who wants to improve the department, including his critics. But he says they need to recognize that changes must be made. While he says the review wasn't perfect, it's time to move on.
The review's the review, I'm not going back to do a second or third or fourth revision of it. That's not the goal of it. The goal now is going forward for me.
Wilson says it remains important for the union to have Walker retract the review findings. He says the union wants to clear the officers' reputations. He also says they've been criticized by family members of people who died in jails and have received threats.
I am going to take every action that's necessary to make sure that the public knows that those officers did not commit a crime and they did nothing wrong and that they followed policy as they were supposed to. And their names need to be cleared and the governor and Dean Williams needs to do it.
The legislature is considering whether to confirm Williams' appointment. Wilson says he'll probably ask lawmakers to vote against Williams after hearing Williams defend himself in a House State Affairs Committee hearing this week. Williams says it's awkward for him to tell legislators how to vote, but he says he wants to complete changes to the department.
I think people have to vote their conscience and understand where I'm going or not, and either have to believe that that is truly where I'm heading, or they have to get to the point like, no, that's not what he's doing. He's got some sort of other agenda. And anyone who's spent 5 minutes with me, who can look at my face and see where I am at, knows that I'm going somewhere because I think something needs to be done.
The House State Affairs Committee sent Williams' name to the entire legislature for a confirmation vote. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Nationally, longer fire seasons and more destructive fires have put the Forest Service in a bad place. To pay the cost of fighting mega fires, the agency has had to raid other programs, including its fire prevention budget. Senator Lisa Murkowski chairs the subcommittee that writes the Forest Service spending bill. She supports a plan to end so-called fire borrowing. But Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell told her it's not working out like they'd hoped. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Last year, more than half of the Forest Service budget was consumed by wildland fires, up from 16% two decades ago. Murkowski and Tidwell both support a new arrangement where Congress will move 30% of the firefighting expense off the Forest Service budget. If next year's fire season costs more than Congress appropriates, some fires would be funded as natural disasters. But looking over the Forest Service budget proposal for next year, Murkowski says she doesn't see the agency making good use of the money it no longer needs to keep for emergencies.
Because as I look at it, you've got a decrease, a proposed decrease in National Forest Management, only a very small increase for hazardous fuel reductions.
The senator says Alaskans want to see more fire prevention, particularly after the 2014 Funny River fire on the Kenai Peninsula.
In the wake of that fire, we had 11.3 million acres that were identified as high priority for fuels reduction. Again, folks at home are real concerned about what may be coming with this fire season.
Tidwell told her they're treating more acres every year to make them less fire prone.
And yes, there is a backlog out there that I've been very clear about.
So why not take some of that money that you're allocating towards LWCF and put it towards that?
Well, LWCF is another one of our programs that has tremendous public support.
That's the Land and Water Conservation Fund, essentially buying more land on the borders of national forests. The Forest Service wants $66 million for land acquisition. That's small compared to the nearly $400 million it's seeking for hazardous fuels reduction. But Murkowski says it doesn't make sense for the agency to buy more land when it can't take care of what it has. The real budget culprit, Tidwell says, is the ever-increasing cost of fighting fires. When they began trying to move some firefighting expenses out of the Forest Service budget 2 years ago, the chief said, they both assumed it would free up money for other programs.
But what's happened over the last 2 years is that cost of fire suppression, as it keeps going up, it's basically eliminated that potential savings.
One reason for increased cost is the longer fire season. And when asked by one of the Democratic senators, Tidwell says he knows the cause.
Climate change. It's just that we have our weather, it's hotter and drier, and what we're seeing is that it's warming up earlier in the spring and it stays warmer later into the falls. And where it used to be come Labor Day, we were pretty much out of fire season. And anymore that, it goes way past Labor Day.
That fits this month's fire outlook for South Central Alaska. With the low snowpack, forecasters say the risk of wildland fire is already above normal for the Anchorage Bowl and the Kenai Peninsula and will remain elevated until June. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Anchorage firefighters were alerted to a forest fire near McHugh Creek south of the city late last night. The fire was at least 45 minutes up a trail on the north side of the creek, but did not appear to be growing rapidly. Due to the location, darkness, and weather conditions, crews couldn't respond until this morning to extinguish it. Alaska Division of Forestry Fire Management Officer Norm McDonald says six crewmen were dispatched to the site early this morning.
The fire is about 1 acre in size, and it was 30% active as of about midday. The firefighters will remain on scene there throughout the day and then and tomorrow. At this time, we don't have a cause. That's under investigation.
McDonald says the firefighters couldn't get in very far with a fire truck.
They just are pulling everything up to the fire on foot. It's about a mile in off the Rabbit Lake Trail.
McDonald says no homes or structures are threatened by the fire. Alaska U.S. Representative Don Young says he's looking forward to a spirited and energetic campaign as he seeks a 23rd term in Congress. Young is the longest-serving Republican in the U.S. House, and today he gained a Democratic challenger. Steve Lindbeck, the former general manager of Alaska Public Media, announced he will challenge Young. Young spokesman Matt Shukaro says Young has always welcomed all candidates to the congressional race. He says Young remains focused on winning the Republican nomination in Alaska's primary election this August, ahead of the November general election. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, longing for mushing news, the Kobuk 440 gets underway in Kotzebue.
It all depends on people's strategy. Some of them are rookies up here on this race, so we'll just see how it goes and take it as it comes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A GCI fiber optic cable was cut in Midtown Anchorage this afternoon, causing phone, cable, and internet outages across the state. GCI spokesman David Moore says the company has called in extra crews to reconnect the 500 different glass fibers. They are focusing on the fibers with the most traffic, but he says repairs likely won't be complete until tomorrow. Outages vary by location. Some rural areas aren't receiving television channels. Some parts of the state don't have internet access, and cell phone service is spotty. The 2016 Kobuk 440 sled dog race got underway early this afternoon. A mass start sent teams speeding east from the sea ice outside of Kotzebue toward Kobuk, where they will turn around on the out and back route. As KNOM's Emily Schwing reports, trail and weather conditions are prime for a fiercely competitive race.
It was an enthusiastic send-off for dog teams and mushers as they left the start line of the Kobuk 440. Among 15 mushers driving teams in this year's race is Noah Burmeister, who posted an impressive 11th place finish in this year's Iditarod after nearly a decade away from the sport. He's no stranger to the Kobuk 440.
I ran it in 07. Okay. Yeah, so it's been a few years.
Burmeister hopes for a win, but he knows there's plenty of stiff competition with the same goal.
There's some pretty good competition out here. Yeah, there's some good solid teams, but it all depends on people's strategy. Some of them are rookies up here on this race, so we'll just see how it goes and take it as it comes.
Nicholas Petit also placed well in last month's Iditarod. He's new to the Kobuk 440, and he says it's refreshing to be a rookie again.
It's cool. This is my third race this year that I've never been to before. So,
where are you?
Cusco and Denali Doubles.
Petit's dogs are young and inexperienced, but he says he's still racing in the last major competitive sled dog race of this season.
We'll do well, but it's really warm out, and we gotta be somewhat conservative considering that they're really young dogs and they have a lot of miles ahead of them in future years. So I don't want to ruin them for a 400-mile race, but. We'll be moving right along.
After plenty of mid and back of the pack finishes in this and other races in the past, Catherine Keith is also looking to up her game in this year's Kobuk 440.
I want a high placing team. I want to be competitive. I think we've got great dogs this year, and you know, I've had a lot of races now to get some experience. So I hope we can, well, first of all, have a great fun race, enjoy the weather, enjoy the communities, but I'd like to actually race.
Keith could be at an advantage. She and partner John Baker run a kennel that sits just along the shoreline in Kotzebue, not too far from the start line.
It is. It's really fun just to get out on our own trails and to be able to not have to travel to a race. It's something that, you know, we take for granted on this one, but we appreciate it.
According to race officials, trail conditions are excellent. This year's route is relatively flat. There's reportedly plenty of snow and not too much open water despite a spring season that's quickly settling in over the region. But Keith says none of that means the next few days will be easy.
Yeah, it's a competitive, and it's actually a really, really hard race because you have four or five long runs, 80, 90 miles, And that's even the Iditarod, you don't really run that distance very often. And when you're limited to your rest in the checkpoints, you know, you can't really break that up that much. So it's going to be tough for everyone. It's great. That's what's good about the race. It's hard. Otherwise, a lot of people would come up.
Mushers left en masse from Kotzebue under a bright midday sun. The weather's forecast to remain warm with daytime temperatures in the mid to upper 30s or warmer, which could pose a challenge for the large, thick-coated and black dogs that make up many of the teams in this year's race. On the Kobuk 440 Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in Kotzebue.
As potential businesses across the state get ready for commercial cannabis sales, communities are beginning to meet their potential new neighborhood sellers, growers, and processors. As part of an ongoing series profiling one new marijuana business hoping to open up shop, Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes looks at how communities are trying to have a say at the most local level.
Inside the large cinder block multi-purpose room at the Spinard Recreation Center in West Anchorage, the hopeful proprietor of a pot shop stands up to address a few dozen people sitting in plastic chairs.
My name is Jane Stinson. I am a third of a business, a cannabis business called Enlighten Alaska.
Stinson is introducing herself to Spinard's Community Council, the hyper-local body of residents in each neighborhood across the city who weigh in on issues like roads, development, and new businesses coming into the area.
Just let you guys know that this is the face of cannabis.
Businesses like Enlighten Alaska are required by the state to issue public notices to nearby communities as part of their application process. At this meeting, Council President Jedediah Smith says the measure up for discussion is whether or not to set up a small committee that can review permits when the full community council is out of session this summer.
It seems like moving forward, we're not necessarily looking to pass resolutions of support specifically for a business, but more set up a communication agreement with businesses that want to come into the neighborhood.
Which is to say, they aren't for or against anyone just yet. They want a resolution that helps them get to know potential operators like Stinson.
All in favor, 1, 2, 3.
And that's
four.
Not a particularly controversial prospect for folks 12, at the rec center.
17. Any opposed? Great. Motion passes unanimously.
After the meeting, as people stack chairs and dump out the last of the coffee, Stinson says the unanimous vote is a great sign and means she can move ahead drafting what's called a neighborhood responsibility plan to bring to the next council meeting.
A neighborhood responsibility plan is basically an open dialogue, a communication tool that we're going to be using if there are any issues that come up. We have a way to address them and discuss them.
A line of communication is especially important in this neighborhood because a lot of new pot businesses are expected to open here.
Well, I think that Spinard in the past has been known as the red light district. We're concerned that we might become the green light district.
Jay Stange is a vice president of the council and says that because the permit system goes through the state and the full Anchorage Assembly, communities don't really have any binding power over whether or not a business gets approved to open. Instead, they preside over a review of the nitty-gritty details that have a direct impact on residents.
We have the power to regulate these businesses just like we would regulate any other business, by asking them about their parking, asking them about their hours of operation, asking them about traffic impacts.
Stange says the meetings this summer are designed to work through business plans and the particulars all together and get everyone on the same page.
So the role of this committee is to review applications, and right now I think we might have 6 or 7 affecting the Spinard area.
That's more than entire boroughs.
Yeah, it's a number of them. And so we've had questions, you know, in our community, do we want to be the Amsterdam of Alaska?
In other parts of town, this dialogue between the community council and new businesses hasn't gone quite so smoothly. Another area with a lot of industrial zoning and prime real estate for commercial cannabis falls under the Taku Campbell Community Council in South Anchorage. Jeff Lanfield is president of that council and also a candidate running for state senate. And he says in the last 4 to 5 months, meetings have been consumed with presentations, confusing arguments over regulation, and tangents about marijuana.
I think there's a whole bunch of unintended consequences for the people get really excited. They wanted to pass this law. They want to have legal marijuana. But then it's like, where'd they all go when it comes to implementing the policies?
But in Spinard, people seem more interested at this point in how businesses would operate, rather than a referendum on if they should open at all. Stange is a school teacher and has kids of his own. He has thought a lot about the impacts of commercial cannabis at the community level, and he says what local groups have some influence over is helping a business like Stinson's figure out how to be a good neighbor in the months ahead.
We're trying to have an open line of communication with these people who want to be our neighbors and want to be our vendors, and we want to make sure we know them. We want to make sure they know us, and we want to make sure that whatever they do, it's going to be a positive thing in our community.
Stinson, with Enlighten Alaska, is happy to oblige. Even though she lives in a different part of town, she's begun paying dues to be an official member of the community council in Spinard. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The Alaska Gold Panners baseball team officially announced its new contract with the Fairbanks North Star Borough yesterday. Last year, the semi-pro ball club tangled with the borough over safety issues at its home field, Groden Park. But as KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, differences have been set aside, so the tradition of the Midnight Sun game continues.
Both Borough Mayor Carl Castle and Gold Panner Board President John Lorkey Wednesday expressed enthusiasm over the contract they inked last week. 6 months ago, it was anyone's call whether the semi-pro nonprofit ball club would come to terms with the borough over the degraded facilities and safety concerns at Groden Park. But Wednesday, Mayor Castle sprinkled his remarks with baseball metaphors in describing the partnership he envisions to restore the Gold Panners to glory.
We're going to recruit some money. There's foundations out there that are willing to play ball with us, and we'll bring some of that resource to the plate.
Mayor Castle dismissed earlier estimates it would take millions to bring Groden Park to safe and attractive standards. He said the borough has already ponied up $230,000 to tear down unsafe bleachers and ordered temporary replacements. John Lorkey, who was recently named president of the ball club's board of directors, pointed to the expanded board as an example of the community spirit both he and Castle anticipate.
We've really got different faces joining the board. We've got about 25 to 30 board of directors. And it's active. There's people involved. There's people raising their hands saying, I'll do that. I can take care of that.
The new four-year contract covers five seasons and more clearly outlines Gold Panners' responsibilities at Groden. Under the terms of the agreement, the Gold Panners plan to provide a financial statement to the borough April 20th. As for the season, Lorkey says the club has already recruited its coaches and 22 players. He says after some out-of-town games, it will be ready to meet the Fairbanks All-Stars for the first home game of the season, June 17th. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
A handful of the parents of students who attend Vosnesekna School testified before the Kenai Peninsula Borough School Board Monday evening. They said they did not want the district to shut the school down, which officials say they're considering due to a stalled lease negotiation. KBBI's Daisha Eaton has more.
Frozia Polushkin, a substitute teacher at Vosnesenka School and a parent, told the Kenai Peninsula Borough School Board that the controversy between the board and Vosnesenka Community Council Incorporated, or VCCI, was causing students to worry.
We like our school and we want it to stay open for the sake of our students and culture. The students should not have to worry about this. It is unfair to the students, staff, and community members. I understand that the lease is not settled due to the cost of water. If this is the case, then maybe the water should be brought down or the school board and Vosnesenka Council could work together on settling on a price that are both comfortable with.
VCCI is a nonprofit that owns the school property and buildings. The council and the district have been arguing about the terms of the lease, which expired last June, for more than a year. The district leases school buildings in some Russian Old Believer communities on the southern Kenai Peninsula, including Voznesenka. Under the arrangement, some schools in the Russian villages have never had the same amenities that schools in more populated areas get, like libraries, gymnasiums, and more. Parent Zina Rutov said she didn't understand what the problem was.
So what we don't understand is why the borough doesn't want to pay for our water. I mean, we're taxpayers too.
District officials say KPBSD has agreed to lease Voznesenka school buildings for $1.05 per square foot, or $112,000 per year. They've also agreed to add 2% a year to the lease. However, they're stuck on the issue of who will pay for water. VCCI is asking for an additional $750 per month, or $9,000 per year, to pay for water at the school. They say that's the actual cost of the water through their local utility. The district argues that their offer already includes water. If the school is shut down, Rutov says there will be negative consequences for students.
If you shut down our schools, our students will guarantee dropout. We're not going to send our children to any other KPBSD school or connections. So please have the school stay open, figure out a way to fix this, and we're not asking for much.
In March, Assistant Superintendent Dave Jones asked the principal at Voznesenka School, Mike Wojak, to talk with parents about what might happen if a lease agreement is not reached. A district spokesperson says he told families about other options for elementary, middle, and high school in the Homer area, as well as the district's Connections homeschool program. Varvara Martyshev, who substitute teaches at the school and has children attending there, said she felt that Voznesenka was being treated unfairly by the district.
Just to shut down the school because I'm not agreeing to the water bill does not make sense to me. When there's schools with gyms, cafeteria, construction classes, and a field for sports, which my kids never did have, and there's school around that have less students and have all the goodies with their school than our kids. I feel that we always get the short end of the stick. We want to work together with you guys to have a long-term future plan for my kids and my grandkids to go to Voznesenka School to graduate.
If a lease agreement is not reached, officials say the issue may be an agenda item for the next Kenai Peninsula Borough School Board meeting on May 2nd. In Homer, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're on line at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Kotzebue, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Homer, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Alaska Public Media is seeking donations for our 2016 Big Alaska Statewide TV Travel Auction to be held on May 19th and 20th. We're looking for trips, accommodations, activities, and adventures. Your generous donation will help us in our commitment to growth and excellence in programming on Alaska Public Media. There's more information online on our events page on our website at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.